Picture this, it's August 7th, 1942, just before sunrise over the Solomon Sea. Somewhere below, 5,000 United States Marines are hitting the beaches of Guadalcanal, Tulagi, Tanambogo. The first major American offensive of the Pacific War has just begun, and up at altitude, climbing out of a fighter strip near Rabaul on the island of New Britain, a 26-year-old Japanese warrant officer named Saburo Sakai pushes the throttle forward on his Mitsubishi Zero and points his nose toward the southeast. I'm Tail Dragger. This is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. And today I want to tell you about the most improbable flight I have ever studied, not because of what this man did in combat, but because of what he did afterward. Bleeding, half-blind, 500 miles from home alone over open ocean with no radio and one good eye. Before we get into it, today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, if you don't know the name Saburo Sakai, I want you to hold that thought, because this is the kind of airman who comes along maybe once in a generation, and in the history books of the Pacific War, his name belongs next to the great ones. Sakai was born in 1916 in Saga Prefecture, in southern Japan. His family traced its lineage back to samurai tradition, though by the time Saburo came along, they were poor farmers. He joined the Imperial Japanese Navy at age 16. Not because he dreamed of flying, not in the beginning. He joined because the Navy was a way up. He failed his first flight school entrance exam, failed the mathematics portion. Most men would have stopped there, gone back to the deck, done their time, and gone home. Saburo Sakai went back to his bunk and studied. He returned to the examination. He didn't just pass, he graduated at the top of his class. His flight instructors noted his eyesight almost immediately. His visual acuity was exceptional, even by the already rigorous standards of naval aviation. He could pick out aircraft at distances where other pilots saw nothing. In the air, this matters in ways that are difficult to overstate. In a turning fight, the pilot who sees first almost always wins. He went to China in the late 1930s with Japanese naval aviation forces, flying combat missions over Chinese territory before the Pacific War officially began. By December of 1941, when Japan launched simultaneous strikes across the Pacific, Sakai was already a seasoned combat pilot with years of real fighting behind him. And the airplane he flew. We have to talk about the Mitsubishi A6M-0. The Zero, full designation Mitsubishi A6M Ryzen, which translates roughly to Type 0 carrier fighter, was the dominant Japanese naval fighter of the early Pacific War, and there are not many aircraft in history that changed a conflict the way the Zero did in those first months. It was powered by a Nakajima Sakai 14-cylinder twin-row radial engine, producing just over 1,100 horsepower, light control forces, an extraordinary turning radius. Range that stunned Allied commanders when they first encountered it, because nobody believed a single-engine fighter could operate so far from its base. When the Zero appeared over Pearl Harbor, over the Philippines, over Rabaul, over everywhere, seemingly at once, Allied intelligence was confused. They thought they were seeing multiple aircraft types. It was one airplane. But the Zero had a compromise buried inside it. To achieve that performance, Mitsubishi's engineers stripped out the armor protection and the self-sealing fuel tanks. The aircraft that outturned everything in the sky in 1941 could be turned into a fireball by a well-placed burst of 50 caliber rounds. Every Japanese pilot knew this. They flew it anyway, because there was nothing else, and because the Zero was very good at not getting hit as long as the pilot made no mistakes. By the summer of 1942, Saburo Sakai had accumulated well over 60 claimed aerial victories, making him one of the highest-scoring aces in the Imperial Japanese Navy. He was flying out of Rabaul leading formations, taking on missions that stretched the Zero's range to its absolute limits. On August 7th, when word reached Rabaul that American forces were landing in the Solomons, the Japanese scrambled everything they had. The distance from Rabaul to Guadalcanal is roughly 560 miles, in the Zero at normal cruise power. That is about 2.5 hours of flying, one way. 5 hours of flying total, round trip, before you even count fuel burned in combat maneuvering. The pilots knew they would have perhaps 15 or 20 minutes over the target before they had to turn for home or die in the ocean. The formation flew southeast. Sakai could see the Solomon Sea below, that deep Pacific blue that looks almost artificial from altitude, and ahead of them the smudge of smoke already rising from the invasion beaches at Guadalcanal. They found the Americans. Grumman F-4F Wildcats were airborne. The United States Navy and Marine Corps fighters tasked with protecting the fleet. The Wildcat was slower than the Zero, less maneuverable. But it was built like a tank by comparison. and it had one ace up its sleeve. If you flew it right, you did not turn with the zero. You dove, you fired, you climbed back up. It was a different kind of fight. Sakai performed well that morning. He shot down at least two aircraft before the situation deteriorated. The fight had been long, the fuel was going, and then he made the kind of mistake that happens when a pilot has been in a sustained battle and fatigue starts to compress judgment. He spotted a formation of four aircraft ahead of him, below him, at a distance. They looked like wildcats flying in a loose group, possibly damaged or disoriented. He pushed the Zero's nose down and dove to attack. They were not wildcats. They were Grumman TBF Avenger torpedo bombers, new to the theater. Sakai had either not seen them before or failed to correctly identify them at that distance, with combat fatigue blurring his recognition. Where the Wildcat had limited defensive armament, the Avenger carried a 50-caliber turret on top and another gun position in the belly. All four aircraft swung their guns toward him at once. When Sakai opened fire and closed to short range, what he flew into was essentially a wall of 50-caliber bullets coming from four directions simultaneously. The rounds tore through his cockpit.
A large-caliber round exploded close to his head. Fragments slashed across the right side of his skull and destroyed his right eye. His left arm went numb. His left leg went numb. The cockpit filled with smoke and the sharp metallic smell of rounds that had torn through the airframe, and something else, blood. His own blood was on the windscreen, on his hands, on the instrument panel. He lost consciousness. The Zero nosed over and began a screaming dive toward the ocean. Somewhere in that plunge, the rush of wind, the scream of the engine, something in Sakai came back. He regained consciousness to find himself in a near-vertical dive pointed at the Solomon Sea. He pulled out. The G-force must have been enormous. The Zero's wings held. He recovered level flight. He was alive. He was also 560 miles from home, alone, with one functional eye, a left side barely responding, and fuel he could only estimate because the combat maneuvering had burned reserves he hadn't planned on burning. Now, here's where it gets interesting. What Sakai did over the next 4.5 to 5 hours is one of the most remarkable examples of airmanship under duress I have ever come across in decades of reading aviation history. He turned northwest. He didn't have a working radio. He couldn't call anyone. He could see out of one eye, and that eye was watering and straining to compensate for the depth perception he had lost. His left hand could barely grip the throttle. He had a wound in his skull that, according to the surgeons who later operated on him, should have been fatal. And he flew. He flew northwest, using the angle of the Pacific sun to hold his heading, using his memory of the islands and the coastline to navigate by dead reckoning over open ocean. Dead reckoning with one eye. Dead reckoning while fighting unconsciousness every 20 minutes or so.
He later described the experience of fighting off the blackouts. He would feel the darkness coming at the edges of his vision, feel the aircraft beginning to wander as his grip on the controls loosened, and he would bring himself back by sheer will. He slapped his own face. He pinched the back of his hand hard enough to leave marks. He talked out loud into the open cockpit wind, though no one could hear him. He used pain to stay present because the normal mechanisms of alertness had been stripped away by blood loss and shock. At some point during the flight, he spotted a group of Japanese aircraft headed toward Guadalcanal. He tried to join them, tried to signal for help, or at least for an escort home. His radio was dead. He couldn't make them understand. He fell away from the formation and continued alone. Think about what he had in that cockpit. A 14-cylinder Nakajima Sakai engine that was still, somehow, running smoothly. The vibration of it through the airframe, the smell of exhaust mixing with the copper smell of his own blood. The Pacific light, flat and blinding off the water below, and 500 miles of open ocean between him and home. The Nakajima did not quit. Whatever those four Avengers had done to the Zero, they had not killed the engine. That engine ran for 5 hours. That is a fact I want every pilot listening to sit with for a moment, because it says something about the aircraft even as it says something about the man. He crossed the coastline of New Britain. He found Rabaul. He came in over the strip. With one eye, he had no binocular depth perception. Judging altitude, judging sink rate, judging the flare point at the end of the approach, all of that had to be done with monocular cues, with the size of objects on the runway, with the parallax shift as the aircraft moved through the flare. He came in too fast. He misjudged the round out. He bounced hard off the runway, went back into the air, and settled again. The Zero rolled to a stop. Ground crews ran toward the aircraft and found Sakai slumped forward in the cockpit. Barely conscious, covered in blood, his right eye destroyed, his uniform soaked red. They assumed he was dead. He was not dead.
They rushed him to surgery. The doctors removed bone fragments and shell fragments from his skull and from the tissue around his right eye. They told him he would never fly again. This was apparently the wrong thing to say to Saburo Sakai. He spent months in recovery, most of it back in Japan. He had to rebuild his relationship with spatial information from scratch. Depth perception that the two-eyed visual system provides automatically had to be reconstructed using parallax shift, the relative size of objects, the subtle cues a single eye can learn to interpret if the brain is stubborn enough to teach itself. He worked at it the way he had worked at mathematics before his first flight school exam, which is to say, without stopping. In 1943, Saburo Sakai returned to combat flying with one eye. He flew fighters in an active war zone with one eye and added to his aerial victory total after his return. He survived the remainder of the war, one of only a handful of high-scoring Japanese aces who did. Most of the great ones were gone by the end. The grinding attrition of 4 years of relentless fighting had worn down the Japanese naval air arm to almost nothing. The veterans who couldn't be replaced weren't. Sakai survived partly because after his wound he was eventually rotated to lower intensity assignments. And partly because of a kind of fortune that pilots don't get to choose. After the war he became a civilian. He eventually became a flight instructor. He wrote his memoirs with American authors Martin Kaiden and Fred Saito, and the book that came out of it, published in English in 1957 under the title Samurai, is one of the most honest and vivid accounts of aerial combat that exists anywhere. Not a hero story in the flag-waving sense, a human story written by a man who understood from both sides of the equation what war cost and what flying meant. He attended airshow events in his later years. He shook hands with American pilots, some of whom had been trying to shoot him down at various points. He said of those meetings that the sky had never been the enemy. The men in the other aircraft had never been the enemy in a way that mattered after the shooting stopped. They were pilots, so was he. Saburo Sakai died on September 22nd in the year 2000, at the age of 84. He had been invited to dine with American naval aviators at Atsugi Naval Air Station in Japan. He had a heart attack at the table. He died among pilots. It seems right. I think about that flight across the Solomon Sea often, 560 miles. One eye. A wound that should have been a death sentence by any reasonable medical estimate. And the Nakajima running. And the sun holding its angle in the sky. And a man keeping himself alive by will alone until the runway appeared under him. Every hour you log is a deposit in an account you hope you never need to draw on. Sakai's account was full. Much of this comes from Sakai's own memoir, Samurai, co-authored with Martin Kaiden and Fred Saito, and from the historical research of Japanese aviation historian Henry Sakaida, RadioHangar.com. I'm Taildragger. Safe skies.